Everybody, or good morning, depending on where you are. My name is Manish Parashar. I'm the Office Director for the Office of Advanced Cyber Infrastructure, and it's my absolute pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker today, Pete Beckman. Pete is co-director of the Northwestern University and Argonne National Laboratory Institute for Science and Engineering. He's a leader in the field and has over his career of 30 years has led different aspects of scientific computing systems. His research has focused on software and architectures for large-scale parallel and distributed computing operating systems, as well as networks linking NSF and other supercomputing centers. More recently, Pete and his team have explored cyber infrastructure for the digital continuum, linking AI and edge computing for scientific instruments and high-performance computing and cloud computing. He was part of the pioneering Array of Things project that launched Chicago's edge computing and distributed sensing efforts. And more recently, he leads the NSF Mid-Scale Research Infrastructure One SAGE project, which is building a nationwide cyber infrastructure for AI at the edge to support a wide range of applications, including ecological research using NSF's NEON, National Ecological Observatory Network, major facility. So without delaying any further, let me turn it over to Pete. Over to you, Pete.
All right, thank you. And just double checking, you can hear me well, and we'll get started. So thank you, Manish. It was a very kind introduction. And I want to thank also, you know, Amy Friedlander and Kevin Thompson, who have been encouraging in this project. I will be talking about AI and what's happening in instrument to computation. And it's really the work of many people, some of whom we'll meet today as we look through the slides. Now, I was asked at the very beginning to provide a little self-introduction, maybe something that how I got into science or the what was a turning point in my life. And, you know, speaking of continuum here from curious kid to curious scientist, it really wasn't one event, but I had fantastic teachers, you know, starting with my parents who were both immigrants and teaching me both instruction and technology and other things. To my middle school math teacher and my physics teacher and electronics. And then I went to college and, you know, Professor Stevens and Schaefer and Cruikshank and Harbrun all, you know, contributed. So it really was the fact that I had great educators who just kept encouraging me. And that really made it possible so that I could then go out and do other things and be risky in computer science. And I also now with my wife get to go once a year and work on technology and other projects, clean water with a local pastor in Africa. So we get to keep pushing that forward. So we're talking today about how instruments and computing link. And NSF has a amazing set of investments in this area. The IceCube neutrino detector in Antarctica is a perfect example of instrument that then needs computing both with the instrument and back in the other part of the world, the more connected part of the world. Of course, NEON that Manish mentioned is an enormous instrument distributed, not just one place, but distributed across the United States. And it's measuring ecological changes, climate change. And it also has this data and processing pattern. And of course, if we look into the heavens even further, we can use the observatory in Chile as an example where computation and instrumentation are linked. Now, those are all examples sort of in the large. I work with a collaborator at Northwestern University, Josiah Hester, and even in the small, this pattern emerges where lightweight sensing, in this case for a COVID mask, can be powered by movement and breath and a small battery and do energy storage and do processing right there. And so all of these patterns have this common theme where there's some instrumentation, there's data that's collected, and then we process it, whether it's processing by hand, like Katherine Johnson, who worked at NASA, who processed some of the orbital trajectories, to today's modern processing. But this pattern now, as we look into the future, where we are now, is much more complex. The volumes of data are just staggering. We know now about big data. And so in this digital continuum, we're no longer waiting and doing the analysis all the way at the end on a supercomputer. We have to start that analysis right there at the instrument, whether it's an IoT like that Facebit mask of Josiah Hester's, or it's a large telescope, or it's another kind of large instrument. And furthermore, we know from these instruments that that they produce way more data than we actually send and save. And so analyzing that at the full resolution is critical. So that brings us to the state we're in now, where we must find a way to bring that kind of advanced processing down to the instrument. Now, in the past, for very large instruments, you could design a bespoke configuration. FPGAs were used for accelerators and light sources and radio telescopes to do that processing, that initial processing at the edge. But for many instruments, we need something that's much more flexible and dynamic. Now, you can think of edge computing as kind of, you know, almost the opposite of a supercomputer. Ken Batcher has a famous quote that he said, a supercomputer is a device for turning a compute-bound problem into an I/O-bound problem. For us at the edge, it's the opposite. An edge computer turns an I/O-bound problem into a compute-bound problem. So we start that computation at the edge with LIDAR, hyperspectral images, camera, radar, instrument towers, and then there's also actuation. And so we're going to inject a new kind of computing infrastructure that allows for actuation and adaptation, and then leverages the tremendous advancements in artificial intelligence. So we can do deep learning inference, we could do lightweight training at the edge, we can process and have autonomous action. And on the supercomputer side, we can set up digital twins or do MODEX, model-driven experiments, and process the machine learning. So now I know that it's difficult to move that kind of computation out to the edge. And there's a part of us that says, just buy faster networks. And I've worked on those faster networks before. And so there is a real desire to do that. However, there are really good reasons why we need to move the computation there. All of these kinds of advanced sensors have more data than bandwidth. We just can't move it all. So processing the full resolution data is very important. There's also times when latency is important, especially for actuation. Privacy is another issue. And the work we do with the city of Chicago means that we don't want to stream video and audio 24/7 from these cameras. We want to do that processing and then delete it. Resilience is another reason. With the data center, there comes a single point of success. Being able to distribute processing allows a lot more autonomy. And finally, there's also power and battery reasons where we want quiet, energy efficient observation. So let me introduce Sage. Now, one of the things that COVID taught us is that people are really the most important part. And so rather than talking initially about the tech, I thought I'd just highlight the people. I know this picture of the team from last summer looks strange. We don't normally go to work in that attire, although sometimes we do. Last year we were virtual with all of our students. And so we, snuck out and had a time out on a local river to kayak and get to outdoors so we could actually talk to students and see students and do some more one-on-one discussions. But that kind of action is very important in a large distributed project. So the project, I'll introduce the team members very quickly. Nicola Ferrier is the deputy director. She leads all things AI for the project. Scott Collis, co-PI, works on instrumentation. He's a physicist, but now an atmospheric scientist. Valerie Taylor and Mike Papko work on education. Eugene Kelly formerly worked with NEON and now works with NEON as a collaborator from Colorado State. And Raj, who is the chief architect of the node, but also co-leads the WAGGL project. Ilke is a specialist in data, but recently she has also become a world-renowned leader in fire science and simulation. So we're leveraging that in the project. Charlie Catlett, who was the original founder of the AOT project and manages our urban work. Jim Olds, who manages risk for the project, but his role is actually much bigger in that he is an expert in biology, in ham radio, in computing. And so we leverage that in many places. Dan Reed is the chief architect and, of course, gives us great direction in how to design a facility like this that can be used. Kathy and Helen are project managers and keep us on task because this is a project. Joe Swantek leads the software team, distributed software team, and keeps us on an agile framework of rolling out new updates all the time. And finally, Irene Qualters is on the advisory committee and leads advisory committee. So we go to her and ask her for help. So we'll thank Kevin Thompson, who's a project manager, and now dive into the tech part. So there are a lot of hard, challenging problems in this space. And I pause here for a minute. This is a project. And projects have milestones, and hard problems are things that you accomplish on the way to your milestones. So there's a lot of research here that we can't really address, but we do the best we can as we deliver on the milestones. But this is a ripe area for computer science research. This sort of cyber infrastructure for things at the edge is very new territory. Triggered simulations between edge and cloud, that's something that a postdoc at Utah is working on. Remote instruments have unique environments, and resource management is unique. There really isn't a programming model across the continuum yet. And so it's difficult to design the pieces of code that are laid out. And finally, we're in a very unique position. These partners that we're adding a SAGE to have operational instruments. NEON, for example, is a 30-year instrument, and that data is critical that it's always there. And so any small additions we make to add instruments or to do computing has to be done in a do-no-harm method. So these are some big challenges and great CS problems that maybe later in the afternoon we can talk about. So the project builds on the success of what was done with the Array of Things, which really was the first of these kinds of edge computing into an urban environment. Charlie Catlett led that. And then we took those concepts and said, what would it look like to really make this a facility that could scale up? So we started the SAGE project with this concept in mind of a software-defined sensor. And I know that's a little strange, but I'm going to lay it out here, which is that when you run your software container, sort of a Docker container, AI workflow, all the way at the instrument, you're essentially creating a sensor. That sensor might determine what a plant species are you seeing, or what bird you're listening to, or if there's smoke. But the concept here is that with the right cyber infrastructure, if we can create cyber infrastructure that is pervasive in instrumentation around the United States, then students and postdocs and faculty and scientists could write their own code to live in those instruments and process. They could write software-defined sensors. So our goals for SAGE take that concept of the software-defined sensor and say, let's build a prototype. Let's build a reusable infrastructure for that. So in the case of NEON, let's put that AI right in the instrument hut and try to do processing along the path. So we're building a new reusable cyber infrastructure. It's got to be very well performing and resilient because people are going to depend on it. It has to use the latest tools, Docker, OpenCV, TensorFlow, Kubernetes. And then we have to build a community of people writing code for these components at the edge. And then we, of course, want to deploy this as an experimental test bed and do some new kinds of computing where we trigger from edge to cloud and cloud to edge, and then train up our students. And that gives us the ability to both write these software-defined sensors and process data at a very high rate. So an example here from Neon, there are many sensors that sample things like at 40 hertz, but yet what is really sent when it's all aggregated is, you know, on the minutes scale. And so looking for anomalies and looking for interesting data there is fascinating. So we have four key partners. The first three were part of the original proposal, the Urban Work, HP Ren and WiFire in Southern California, Neon. And then we have special thanks to Doug Toomey and the Oregon Hazards Lab. They have been helping and joining the project, even though they're not officially funded and part of the project, but they find it exciting. And we have a student coming from them this summer, and we hope that we can do more work with them. So they're part of the team. So let me describe what is actually being deployed. So SAGE is cyber infrastructure. It's designed to run on nodes, on things in the environment. Now, it doesn't have to be ours. We can use a Dell server. So it's cyber infrastructure is software. So on the right, you see a server blade that can go in an instrument hut and process that data live and provide those capabilities. On the left is a version that can be outside. It doesn't need an instrument hut. It has a CPU, GPU, and some sensors, you know, tacked on, and it's very expandable. You can add any power over Ethernet sensor you want, just plug it in the bottom and it goes. So SAGE, the nodes of SAGE are one of these styles. Either it's an x86 server with a GPU, or it's an outdoor unit that goes out on a pole. And the architecture for SAGE is easy to describe. The implementation is actually, it has taken Joe and the team a lot of work to do, but the nodes themselves run an embedded Linux that has been strengthened for resilience. It then allows these Docker containers and Kubernetes to run people's code at the edge. And it provides libraries for efficient GPU usage. We have sort of an extreme cybersecurity view. The nodes only phone home. There's no way to remotely connect to a node unless it phones home. So there are no open ports is another way to say that. The data is published into Beehive. That's our cloud infrastructure. And at the cloud, we have an app repository. So all of those Docker containers have to be built such that they can be shipped over to the nodes. And those containers can then be shared open with all of the scientists. We're going to get to talk about that. That is a very fun part of the project. So we are up and running right now. We have nodes spread across the country from the east to Texas, all the way up to Alaska, to Utqiagvik, Alaska, where there's a Neon site, and there is a SAGE blade in an instrument hut up there. And so we have a dashboard that lets us look at that. But the most important thing are the apps, right? So in order for this kind of new cyber infrastructure to take hold, we need to have the capability to write applications for the edge. That means there's a whole programming environment for what it looks like to write an application that runs at the edge. In the same way that there's a program environment for my phone, and I have an app that can run on my phone is the platform. For us, the SAGE node is the platform, and scientists can write code, AI code, that runs on the platform. And we host those codes in an open portal. And here's the portal. You can go take a look. And it has apps that we're going to talk about now that run all those AI components, whether it's calculating cloud cover or traffic state or analyzing avian bird diversity. All of those apps are things that can be compiled and run and shipped out to the node. Now, we've already been deploying in Chicago. And so here Sean is standing at the street corner watching one of the first nodes go up. The nodes are a little bit heavier than when the Array of Things project was going. I have one here on my windowsill, and they don't just carry them up. They use a pulley and they tow them up. And we have projects in Chicago, like this project on the left is looking at a park where they're modifying how water is absorbed to help reduce flooding. And so the processing that happens at the edge will help us understand what's the environment's change to that. We have undergrad researchers who are already using the data from SAGE to process things and to come up with new algorithms. This is a great bit of work from Northern Illinois University, where a camera on the campus is processing using, one of these YOLO networks, very straightforward. Then they process that, they calculate the pedestrians, they then plot that and can show both going across the crosswalk to and from. And so they can understand this is a great student project, but also it's very applicable. We can understand how people are using city infrastructure and look at safety issues. One that I mentioned, sound event detection. This is another great piece of code. And this really demonstrates that that other people's models, like we did with YOLO, but other people's models can be pulled into the SAGE framework. So this is a model, YamNet, which is produced, I think it's by Google. It's available, you can download that model, and that deep learning model has identification for audio, and it buckets things into 100 or I guess there's 500 different types of audio that it can identify and process. And so we can take that, because we have a programming model for the edge, we can take that, wrap it in the SAGE pieces, and then put it out on a node and count car horn honks or sirens or dog barks or other quality of life. So this is a very important example. Another one, we work with scientists both at UChicago and in Wisconsin on diversity, species diversity. Birds are a great, no pun here, canary about species diversity, because they travel so far, thousands of miles. So when a species shows up and when it leaves, it's very important to understand the ecosystem. So again, now this time using the Cornell bird model, we can put that together into the SAGE system and run it. Here, the work of Dario and Bupendra, we have a node that is in a prairie in the south. We also did some recording at the Morton Arboretum. And you can see here, looking at the data, what kind of birds and what kind of confidence in that bird that the model outputs. And so scientists can look through that data and better understand what's happening. The prairie I mentioned in South Chicago, the Paintbrush Prairie, is managed by the Nature Conservancy. And they allowed us to put a sensor there. And we are monitoring and understanding bird species, again, by being able to run code in the device at the edge. A great atmospheric example comes from cloud motion vectors. This is a work of Scott Collis and Bupendra. And believe it or not, a camera that looks up at the cloud, in this case, it's looking down on a reflective dome that looks up at the clouds, and being able to know in real time where clouds are moving and how and categorize those clouds is an important research topic. And again, can't stream all the data, process it right at the source. And here, in this case, there are some hard problems to overcome. When ice forms on the dome, that top picture in the middle is ice on the dome, and the AI has to be able to detect that. The bottom picture, of course, when it's raining and it's foul weather. We also collect training data, and foul weather can sometimes lead to foul birds. In this case, a training data where a bird landed on the dome, and the AI has no idea what to do about this, but it's a good example of that anomaly and outlier detection algorithms that these sort of AI programs need. Measuring water and snow depth is another key application. There are many, this is a picture from Neon. There are many sites though that put sticks in the ground to measure snow or water depth. And then, you know, I'll say it's current state of the art is a grad student or some a worker would go out and they'd look and they'd write on a clipboard what that value is. And if you have a camera focus on that, you might be able to zoom in enough and you might be able to look. But really, we want to develop AI algorithms that find that stick, that find the measurement and use computer vision. And here, Songhua Park has been working on using UNet and ResNet and self-supervised learning to identify what the water level is. Now, if we can do that for water and snow, then all of these cameras that are deployed around with water and stick will let us get live data measurements where we could put that into hydrological models and find out what's happening. Is it starting to flood? We get really live measurement. And one of our postdocs, Dario, is also looking at how to use self-supervised segmentation to automatically find the stick. So a human doesn't have to go in and identify the bounding box. And so this is merging both what kind of computation we need at the edge with what kind of benefit we're going to get in measuring our environment, whether it's diversity in bird species or water depth and snow depth or traffic or pedestrians. Now, one of the projects that Nicola worked on with students is to understand water on, this is a park in a economically disadvantaged area of Chicago that doesn't have a lot of investment in sewer and water processing. And so there's a lot of places that flood. And so can we use cameras to design an automatic processing at the edge that would allow us to make a hydrological model that would then know when flooding has happened. 3 hours from now, it's likely to flood, given all the data that we're collecting in real time by looking at what's happening on the surface in streets, in parks, in other places. This is using DeepLab V2 with the ResNet 101 backbone and plugging these things together. Again, using the best AI tools we have with a new kind of environment for the edge. We've also started work with Utah, and we have a node that's on top of the Field Museum there, looking down, both looking at the mountain. And we have a new kind of air quality sensor that they've attached. But we're also looking with the Power Project, which is looking at new kinds of wireless to connect those radios, those software-defined radios, to a SAGE node, so that you could do processing of what's happening in the spectrum, again, live in real time, but then open that up to anyone who wants to try out their code with a Docker container can ship it over and have it run in the node. So these are examples of things that are happening today with SAGE. Now we're gonna shift into wildfire, which has become a very important topic since the project started. The West has been very dry, and being able to understand wildfire automatically by using computation running in cameras, running in simulation modes on supercomputers, and pairing that together across the digital continuum is a great project. Now, Ilke, as I mentioned, leads that. Frank Vernon from UCSD runs HP Ren, which is a big networking capability in Southern California. And Doug Toomey has been working with the Alert Wildfire along with Bill Kay, who has deployed hundreds of cameras around the West. And can we AI enable them with edge computing so that we can get better at automatically predicting and understanding smoke? So that's the backdrop. Now let's look at this. So one of the current methods of smoke detection has been just to look at an image. And the San Diego group, the California group, has a model that does that. It works. It looks, but it looks at a single image. And smoke detection is hard because it's really the motion of the smoke. So there are people who are working on LSTMs and motion-based smoke detection as well in California, in Berkeley, and other places. We wanted to also look at, could we do self-supervised learning? Could we use an infrared camera that looks at smoke and understands it's hot, and then train the RGB camera to and the RGB using the RGB camera train a model. So we can look at on the right is the infrared camera, and on the left is the real live image. And so we started working with the NEON team, and they have a kind of tower called a MDP, a mobile deployment platform. And Eugene Kelly at Colorado State, along with the collaborators, Rommel at NEON and others, they deployed one of these towers at a tall grass prairie, one of the very few remaining original tall grass prairies in Kansas. And they prepared it and put it there ahead of a controlled burn. Now on this tower are all the NEON instruments. And then we've augmented those with SAGE processing nodes. We have three SAGE processing nodes plus one in the instrument hut, which is a SAGE blade, plus an infrared camera that's been power over Ethernet jacked in, plus a air quality sensor that's been jacked in. So now we can look at a full range of information and in a real fire, understand what's happening. And so this is a video. Rajesh went down with a drone and took a video. It's a minute and 45 seconds. I'll narrate through this very quickly. So here, some of the experimental patches have been burned. This is the NEON MDP tower. It has an instrument array on the top. And as we come down the tower, you'll see there are three wild SAGE nodes. These have NVIDIA NX GPUs in them, and they're processing in real time what it sees, the smoke detection algorithms. Also, we have that sensor. So after burning the experimental plots, which are these square plots that are in the area, it's managed by Kansas State. Then they went to start burning the area around the tower. And yes, the tower is burned 360. They move the wires while they're burning it, and they lay patches down. Now here is some of that video where it shows what's happening on the infrared camera and how we can use that to train what's happening in the visual camera. So in a future project, we hope students and postdocs will take AI data like that and use it to then train new models that do better at wildfire prediction and wildfire monitoring. And so there's a real human goal to this. We have a technology partner, Arm has been a big supporter, and of course, all of the project folks from both from NSF and from NEON and from Argon that have been helping in a variety of ways. So that tower has now been shut down, and the data, though, about 250 gigabytes of data, has been harvested, and San Diego has already put it up on a site and made a DOI. So if you're interested in looking at that data and exploring that data from the MDP, you can do that. We also have a collaboration that we're starting now with CSIRO in Australia. We're sending 10 nodes to Australia, where they have a computer science group called Data 61, and they're looking at new kinds of models. Again, by running code in that infrastructure, they can run models and understand what's happening at the edge with respect to urban growth, water. They're also very interested in wildfires. As you know, Australia has quite an issue with that. Now at the bottom, I show the user's manual. In order to deploy nodes in Australia without going there, although it's been made a little bit easier that COVID has relaxed a bit, we have a very sophisticated installation manual that we can send people who are installing those combined nodes together. We also have a fantastic partnership with the Ojibwe Nation. It's a sovereign tribe in Wisconsin and surrounding states. They're very interested in climate change, especially as it relates to manumen, which is the Ojibwe word for wild rice, what we call wild rice. And we've been working with Kim from Northwestern University, and she has been to the tribal council meeting and prepared and gotten permission from the tribal council to allow us to install a node that we can then use to help monitor things like the river and wild rice and wild rice beds. And so we have the red oval there is where they picked out a place on a pole. It's pretty remote, but we believe we can get enough networking to pull that data in and then work as a partner with the sovereign tribe to look at the data. So all the data will be hosted and shared with the tribe, and they will have copies of all that data in a sovereignty agreement that we have with them. We're also working with Josiah Hester with a Native Hawaiian community, and we're hoping to be able to deploy one of the nodes. We've just been working on how to get it there and get it deployed. And in this case, it's to a traditional fish pond made by their ancestors. And again, they want to study the impact of climate change and allow students to write code for those components. Now, I want to pause here as we're pretty far into the discussion and just point out that we've talked a lot about nodes. And so you might be tempted to start thinking Sage is a physical thing, like the node on my desk. But really, I want to just remind everyone, it's cyber infrastructure. It's software that happens to need a physical embodiment in many cases. So it can run on an x86 blade and use other people's sensors. So for the Neon example, we're pulling data. We can pull data from their PhenoCams and from the eddy covariance calculations and pull that right into Sage. So it's possible. However, when you're deploying outdoors, you need to weatherproof that box, and that's what's happening. So any kind of sensor can be added with the exception that we don't do Windows. So if there's a proprietary Windows driver for a sensor, we don't want to work on that. But anything that has an open protocol, that air quality monitor was something that Doug Toomey from Oregon recommended. We got it. We figured out the protocol. We set Linux up and it's reporting in, and we can live stream and process the data in real time. We have a portal that allows us to look at that data in real time. So that data is shipped to the Beehive and you can zoom in and understand what all the data is being sent and what's happening to it. It can be connected with a live API. So if you have an HPC program that you want to pull live data from Sage and connect your HPC program to the edge, that's possible. You can also download TARD zip files if you like. So we have a lot of online resources from tutorials and the data that was collected, the status. You can look at the admin page. We're starting, it's not quite released yet, but we're starting to a visualizer for the job scheduler. So one of the key parts for this, I'll talk a little bit more about, is you have to be able to run shared jobs on a shared infrastructure. Kind of like what we do with supercomputers, we are sharing the edge. And so that's a key feature. So we're developing a way to understand and visualize that. Now the nodes that are physical, are manufactured at a local manufacturing company. And so those are manufactured, put on racks and burned in and sit for quite a while as tests run and then eventually boxed up and put on pallets and shipped to our collaborators. Now, of course, if you have an instrument hut, then a Dell Blade, or if you have a big instrument like a telescope, then you'd have a rack. But you could still run Sage, but you'd have a rack of servers. And in this case, what you see here is for the manufacturing of those nodes. The nodes have been extensively tested. So given to a company that freezes them, sprays water on them, blasts them with dust, puts them in a chamber to test RF emissions. They, in this case here, they put about 5 or 6 inches of ice on it, then let it melt. And so we've worked through all of those issues to make sure that they last and are in the field a long time. We've also hosted our first hackathon where we had 4 people who are connected to the project in some way, whether in Texas, in Utah, in Oregon, to get on and log into a node and develop an AI code or try and practice with an AI code that's running at the edge and reporting back. And so Yong Ho and Sean led that tutorial effort, and we plan on repeating that. That's a very important part of our project is that that set of applications, we have about 12 applications now that can be run at the edge. And we're talking to partners all the time about new applications. For example, it's not quite ready. That's application that measures graduated depth in water or with snow. That's still under development. And we would love for a computer science group at a university to take over a set of applications and develop them. And so these hackathons will let us develop the AI community that can run in that full distributed instrument. Now, I gave a teaser earlier about multi-tenancy. This is a hard problem. And it's unlike other problems in that the way we manage most resources, sort of supercomputer resources, is you submit job to a queue and you wait your turn. And if it happens to be 5 hours, it happens to be 10 hours, you're okay with that. You have other work to do and you come back and you check your results. For the edge, we have a different problem because phenomenon happen in real time. It's raining now. I detect bats now. I'm interested in this anomaly that's happening in the eddy covariance right now, because the anomaly is happening right now, and I need that code to be running to process that and understand what's happening at the full resolution right now. So there's a very difficult, almost tense relationship between the urgency of running applications and when they need to run and how to trigger them. So it's a new kind of scheduler, and Yong Ho Kim has been pioneering the work for that, and we've decided that instead of like time slices, like you get on a supercomputer, we have to share, we have to multi-tenant. And in some cases, you have to share the GPU. And so examples of these kind of science goals might be based on time of day. It might be based on it's hot, it's raining, it's the water level is so high. Or it might be based on a prediction that's outside of the node. So this is where that model-driven experiments are so important, right? The connection across the digital continuum. If you know a hurricane is coming, if you know that conditions for flood, for tornado, or extreme drought are occurring, that derecho, that event is happening, you should be able to send code and priorities and set the science goals to the edge that this is the important thing. Here's how to set up and run. And of course, that edge component also has an automation component. So you can see here on the right, we have two different plugins. That's what we call the components that run. They run and can alternate, or they can run simultaneously. And of course, then share the resource. So we also have a strong education focus. Now, this is an area that's actually easy to get students interested in. It's cyber physical, right? You have things that you're looking at, there are pictures, there are audio, there are sensor readings, there's temperature, there's pressure, there's so many things that they're very familiar with that they want to explore. And so Mike Papke and Valerie have worked to build a kind, and this was during COVID, to build a kind of kit that was cheap, $300, and could go to be used by a handful of students. It includes an NVIDIA Jetson Nano, which is a real, edge GPU. And it allows them to do projects that include, like, can you tell when your air conditioner is turned on and off by the noise? Can you run those YOLO image detectors? What other things? And they all started Jupyter Notebooks to do this. So this has been a fantastic project sort of at that level. But we've also worked all the way down into eighth grade. And we have a program that has pulled these students in. We have help with a partnership with NIU Stream and with Argonne's education department to pull in at-risk and other students. And so we have a great diverse crowd. And we have had several camps that have run introduction to AI, challenges, understanding ethics with AI, and then get to the computation part. Understanding, even just running the Merlin app to understand what is happening, how does that work, and what can we write code for to understand from the edge to the cloud. So what are the next steps for Sage as we look to the future? So we have, 70, 80 nodes already in the field. Some of them are at the warehouse. They're in the field burning in at the warehouse. They're about to be shipped to other places. Nodes are being built. We're trying to increase the number of Sage blades that are out with partners. And so our plan over the next 6 months and a year is to deploy more nodes, get more endpoints for edge computing. Also to integrate more advanced sensors. Now I show a sensor here. We've worked with Aaron Kennedy before, and he's built his own instrument. And that instrument is a snowflake camera. There are strobe lights and cameras, and as snow falls, there are many kinds of snow. I didn't really fully appreciate how many types of snow and snowflake and sleet and other things fall. And to do that in real time, so that requires real edge processing and visual computer vision in real time, so that eventually you could get real data as to what's falling from the sky in real time. We also want more students, more hackathons, and hopefully this summer more kayaking. We will be in person this summer. And so that is very exciting. We've already, I saw this morning, one of the students walking down the hall. And so we're just very excited to get them engaged in these AI apps. We also are looking at more partners. The Mount Washington Observatory, we've had a wonderful conversation with them. And they already have some sensors out there. Of course, the problem is they get very, very, very cold. So what we think we'd start with is to put a Sage blade and process, see if we can process the imagery to give rime ice depth on towers and other things in real time. That would be very exciting. That's a future project. We're not there yet, but we hope that that's something we could accomplish. There's a great new park in the south side, southeast side of Chicago called Big Marsh. It's hundreds of acres. It's in an old sort of more industrial area, but it's a wonderful park where people ride bikes and mountain bikes. And there's a lot of avian diversity there. And they're very interested in what that land use and visitors and what's happening around the city. The Nature Conservancy, we've already deployed with them in the past. They're like to expand that. The Lincoln Park Zoo, we have a partnership there. And we want to add anomaly detection as well. So what we've been focusing on currently is running code at the edge that is using AI and deep learning and doing essentially inference. We've explored lightweight learning as well. But we noticed that in some of the instrument streams, there are anomalies. And this is a real one from the NEON MDP. And this is just their vibration sensor. It's a gyroscope. It's a 3D vibration, right? And the NEON tower is sampling this data. And because they've allowed us to put the Sage infrastructure there to monitor our instruments, but also get live the data stream, we look at this data stream and we see that on May 5th, there's an event. Now, whether it's eddy covariance or it's vibration, these kinds of anomalies are really key to be able to understand, okay, well, what was this event? In this case, we believe it was a workman starting to work on the tower and put new instruments on, but that vibration could impact other readings. And so all of that kind of anomaly detection across multiple data streams, whether it's a telescope or it's an instrument that's distributed or audio processing or hyperspectral or all that kind of anomaly detection and playback. So you could pull back the data before and capture the data after an anomaly is very important for tuning instruments at full resolution. Now I mentioned that we love students and we have a lot of projects that we would love to see progress on. These are things that while we talk to scientists about the digital continuum, they come back to us and say, oh, this is what I would really love. I'd really love to be able to understand wildlife movement in real time. I'd like to understand bike lane dynamics, right? How are people using bike lanes? Or I want to understand just using the debris that is floating in a river, I want to understand the speed of the river, or looking down through the water, its turbidity, or measure, calculate biodiversity by listening to, that's again with a project with Susanna in Wisconsin, understanding all, whether it's bats or insects or mammals or birds, measuring biodiversity quickly, measuring ice and ice coverage. All of these kinds of computations are ripe for AI and for students to bite one of these off, to start with one of the initial new networks, start with one of the models and then modify it, or to just use a new method entirely. And so there is tremendous promise here in motivating and in exploring for curious scientists and curious students to how they could run code on Sage. And the great news is they really could run that code on Sage. They could get an account, they could write a piece of code that lives in a Docker container, and then ship that out and see the data live. So we're back to this question, which I shared at the beginning, which was, as we look at programming this new digital continuum, we have decades of experience on the supercomputer side, from MPI and math libraries and PETSI and job schedulers and the great work of the networking teams that put up 100 gigabit links between all of the centers. And now places like TAC are injecting Jupyter notebooks and live visualization. And so we have tremendous amount of experience there. What can we do, and how open could we make the edge to link that full digital continuum? Could we put Sage on a radar truck, right? These steerable, drivable radar trucks. Can we put them in the planes? Can we do live processing on drones? What can we connect? Telescopes, microscopes, where will we do processing, and what will that cyber infrastructure look like? That's different from our cloud infrastructure that we have with Amazon and Azure and Google, and even our own sort of NSF and clouds and infrastructure like Chameleon. What does that look like as we pull that down, like what Sage is doing? Can we build a full environment of scientists that link large-scale NSF facilities and distributed facilities and allow people to program those facilities? So with that, I want to thank, we have a lot of folks who have been part of the project. We've had students since 2013 when we first started exploring AI and edge computing. At that time, the term edge computing wasn't really used. So we were struggling with, what do we call it? We want to process right there at the instrument. And in 2020, we were fully virtual, but we're very excited about getting back and using those student teams throughout the year and working with San Diego and with Colorado and Oregon and Utah and Texas and all of our partners in deploying new kinds of technology to allow new instruments and new science to be done. So with that, I think we have time for questions. Last night, Rajesh found this picture. It's from 2015. It's one of the very, very first installations of the proto work that would eventually become Waggle and Sage at the Nature Conservancy. And I'm sure they're working safely, strapping this up there. Liliana, one of their PhD students, was there to snap a picture. So we're happy about those from humble beginnings to now working in a distributed way across the country. So with that, Manish, I'll turn it back to you, and I can either stop sharing or look at some slides.
No, thank you, Pete, for an absolutely fascinating talk. A virtual round of applause for Pete, please. We have a few questions that have come in, so let me read them to you, and maybe we can get you to answer them. So the first one is from Donald Wunsch. What if somebody wants to pay for another sage node to be added at a place of their choosing?
That's a very good question. And in fact, our NSF program manager, Kevin, has been pushing us on that question because that scalability is very important. So we can obviously produce these nodes, and the electronics company can produce them for us. And the hard part is integrating them into that full infrastructure. And so we are able to do that, and we'd love to talk to you about your science problem. One of the questions that we've had several NSF projects propose to deploy this technology as part of their project. So both for the Ojibwe, but also in the city of Chicago, and also a project in Finland and other places where the next step is to be able to make it more available so that people can get both a sensor, either they can buy the Sage Blade, a Dell server, or they can get the version that goes outdoors and then integrate the software. So we're, in some sense right now, we're, think of us as a cloud provider in that case, which is that we would give an account and we would let people log in to their node and start to develop AI applications for it. So we'd love to talk to you about places where processing data at the edge is possible. And we're trying to work out a more well-structured plan for how external partners who are not sort of NSF partners would be able to do that.
Thank you, Pete. So here's another one from Marcus Pan. While 5G and 6G technology improves the bandwidth latency from the edge to HPC significantly, will you still recommend to process the same data that you're presented over here? What seismic change would you envision for the edge processing?
Yeah, no, that's a very good, this is a really insightful question. I'm going to throw up this slide here. So there are some projects that are happening at the DOE that are using the core Waggle platform, that's the hardware box, and for understanding vehicle, understanding non-proliferation in urban, and in a CRADA with Exelon, but also with 5G and digital. And we work with Randy Berry at Northwestern University. And your question is spot on, which is one of the key features of 5G is that technically you're able to run code in the tower. So what they call the MEC, right? And the multi-user tower. Now, the way Verizon and other companies are doing this right now is sort of virtual machine. They have a rack of x86 servers in the base of the tower, and there are a lot. The hope is that eventually becomes like a cloud service for 5G providers. So the idea, of course, would be if you have a game or an app that needs low latency, then you would just connect to the tower and code could run right there to give you your answer. So that means that this digital continuum, to answer your question now, that means the digital continuum has multiple sites along the path. So there's the edge, right, all the way at the instrument, then 5G and other new advanced networking and things like Fabric might provide computing one step into the network. And then finally, you go all the way to the cloud. So there's tremendous opportunity. 5G is going to lower latencies in many cases and give us improved bandwidth and steerable bandwidth. And in our project, we're looking at choosing the spectrum to use, kind of like the advanced work the Powder Project is doing. But then there are more locales, more places to run code. And that will make this programming model that I said is currently missing, even more important for us to solve.
Thank you. So the next question is asking, and this is from Deborah Penchoff. It says, thank you, Pete. This is great. Is there a mailing list or other communication channel to get announcement for future hackathons? events.
Yes, that would be great. So on the SAGE website, there's a sagecontinuum.org. I believe there's a link to the help line. I think it's support@sagecontinuum.org. And if you just email that, we'll get you connected up. So support@sagecontinuum.org, and that'll get you there.
Thank you. There's a question here from Anjali Bonsai. It says, if we have edge computing on multiple facilities, can you elaborate on the challenges of integrating the data to get a holistic perspective on the coupled climate system? Thanks for a great talk.
Well, yeah, that is a hard problem. And it's a very good problem, is that one of the things that we've noticed is that most of the sensors that different groups put out different sensors. So there's the Ameriflux set of sensors. There are NEON sensors. There are the DOE has a set of sensors called ARM, which are in the Southern Great Plains. We have in Oklahoma, we have a node there. And these things are generally not well connected. They each go to their own data bucket in the cloud. And so I think there is tremendous opportunity in two areas. One is, how do we fuse that data well for architects and scientists who want to study climate or movement or human activity or urbanization? How do we put those two data sets together? But second, at the edge, can we be more flexible in gathering data such that we can share it across multiple instruments, across NEON, across Ameriflux, across ARM, across the next gen drones that will fly and collect data? So this is I think this is actually listed as a big challenge, one of the big challenges for NSF, the data revolution. And this is squarely in the middle of that kind of challenge.
Thank you, Pete. Here's a question from Hans Krim. How are the edge units and sensors powered? How critical are power concerns in the device architecture?
Really, really good question. And so we have been very fortunate that in the places we're currently deploying, there is line power. And the city of Chicago, for example, gives us a 10 amp circuit to use, but we know that that's an impediment. So we have a very clear power budget. The indoor nodes, those SAGE blades that go in instrument huts, when we talk to the people who have instrument huts, they tell us, well, we have 100 watts, you know, or we have less, or we have 200, but you can't, and the temperature gets to be this temperature, and then we're going to cut things off, right? So power is critical. In the independent nodes that sit outside, you know, 50, 70 watts is what we've designed for. But one of the goals that we have, we've been asked by our collaborators in Oregon to design a version that would use 48 volts, right, or 24 volts. Excuse me. And that would allow us to run off of places that are even more remote, that are solar powered. And so maybe even for the Hawaii deployment, we may need to look at what it would take to adjust our plan and see if there's a way to be powered off of solar so we can get a 30, 40 watt package deployed.
Thank you. We have another question from Lisha Zhang. Given the scale and multi-tenant nature of the system, wonder what kind of security solutions have been built into the system?
Yeah, thanks. Another great question. So there are two parts to that I'll answer. The first part, I'll just repeat from a little bit, explain a little bit more what I said earlier, is because these nodes originally are going places, you know, very remote, even whether it's in an instrument hut or it's outside, they need sort of extreme reliability. So in the nodes that are designed for outside, Rajesh and the team have, you know, multiple booting that can happen. If it can't boot this image, it falls back and waits some period of time and boots another image. And so there's high resilience. But on the cybersecurity side, they only phone home, right? So we're very you know, you can't ever be too confident with cybersecurity, but we feel pretty good about the fact that it's hard to penetrate because the place of penetration is the servers in the cloud at Northwestern, and you would have to go through the Northwestern cybersecurity issues because these things are only phoning home. And then they open a bi-directional communication, but it's only phoning home. But from the cybersecurity of the data and the running code, that's a harder challenge. You might know that Docker and other containerization technologies suffer from weaknesses in cybersecurity. And so multi-tenancy means for us that we have two tenants who are willing to share. Now they get separate Docker instances and they're separate, but you know, they could interfere with each other. So we assume that they're not adversarial in sharing the node because you know, you are sharing a scientific instrument. And that's not a, I don't think that's outlandish to start with that position, which is that the people using the instruments are not adversarial, who are given accounts, right, to use the edge. So that's our current position, but we believe there's a lot of R&D space to evolve that. And we've talked to scientists at Northwestern and at Pittsburgh and other places that look at technology that would use the encryption capabilities of the modern chips and the safe areas of the modern chips to allow for components to be locked down so that no one could look inside your container.
Thank you, Pete. We have another question from Donald Wish. Are the data taken shared so that people can use it for meta-analysis, benchmarking? Do the projects also share code?
Yes, both great questions. So the first question is, if you go to our GitHub site for Sage and Waggle, all the code is open source. All of it is open source. If you go to portal.sagecontinuum.org, you can see all 12 of those AI apps and you can download them. It takes you right to their GitHub page. So one of the tenets of this kind of cyber infrastructure is you're building systems so that other people can leverage them and build on top of them. And so that means they have to be open. And we've started all of our conversations with teams saying we have to have open code. Now on the data side, all the data is shared immediately to the cloud. It's open. We have two exceptions, however. So one is there are times where we collect training data, which is data that we're going to later use for AI algorithms to build models. And that data should not be posted on the internet. Examples are from the city of Chicago. We have an agreement with the city of Chicago that if we occasionally take a picture of pedestrian movement so that we can then improve our algorithms in calculating pedestrian traffic, that's fine. We can share that with other researchers, but we're not going to post that to the world. So those kind of training data are policy protected. And the second case is with the native tribes, sovereign tribes. And there are some data that might turn out to be culturally sensitive. And so we're cautious and we work with them very closely to make sure that we can understand how that data can be stored, where it might be stored. It might not be stored on our servers. It might be stored on their servers. So we're trying to work that out with them.
Thank you. Ken Wang asks, do you foresee application of mobile sensors, instruments in space, et cetera? What new issues would arise?
Yeah, that's a fun one because I don't know how much of my office you can see, but you know, we like to tinker. And so, you know, whether it be drones or other mobile robots, we were very interested in what kind of processing we could do at the edge. And there already have been groups that have done things like built a drone that has a NVIDIA GPU, and that NVIDIA GPU is processing, looking for power lines. So the idea would be you would launch the drone and have it follow the power lines, especially after a tornado or some event, and just map them, what's happened to them, right? Get video feed of that. that doesn't need a human operator to, you know, pilot. So that AI at the edge, we believe Sage could provide a very interesting space for that, where you, again, you could write your Docker container, ship it off to the drone, the fleet of drones, and change it up. Okay, we're now looking for a particular rescue truck that we haven't been able to contact. You know, this is the image of the rescue truck. So if any of the drones sees this rescue truck, please land and set up communications back, right? There are all sorts of scenarios where mobile processing like that might be very interesting. And I'll mention one other thing that we are starting to explore, again, in the hobby sense, is mobile and satellite communication. So there are several companies, Swarm.space, which was just bought by SpaceX, have picosats, and they you can burp up small packets of data. So that picture here of Aaron and Bill might be later in the middle of Alaska or the Amazon, and all the processing, did you see this species? What's happening on the ground? What's happening with flooding? Could be reduced and analyzed into just a few packets that you could, you know, spit up to the satellite. So we have one of those test units that's on my kitchen counter at home, and I'm hoping to get some time, you know, hacking on that. And in fact, satellites have been doing a kind of edge processing too, because they can't possibly pull down all of the data. And so they look for particular events and process it. But again, power is a big problem in space. So it's ultra, ultra low power processing there.
Okay, thank you. We have an anonymous question that starts by saying, great presentation, appreciate the focus on complex systems in the outside environment. Do you see similar opportunities or challenges for edge cloud computing in network manufacturing IoT environments, perhaps across different companies where privacy is a significant concern?
Yes, I would say that privacy comes up very frequently. And it's a good thing. I mean, I really think it's a great way for us to understand what data is being collected and why. And edge computing gives us a way to get our hands wrapped around that. One is all the algorithms are public and all the processing is public. We can see the codes. We know what is being processed at the edge. But you know, I would love to see that kind of rigor applied everywhere. You know, I've been to the new kinds of stores where they look at video and how you move and understand whether you've purchased something or intend to purchase something. In manufacturing, it's happening all the time. This issue is one where there's R&D that's very key and very important here. And I know that NSF has projects in the privacy space, and this is and security, this is a very ripe computer science problem to address. And the kinds of processing that we can do on the very smallest devices and IoT devices is also an area of interest, whether it's just anomaly detection. So a device is, it can't run a full Linux Docker container, but maybe there's a little snippet of code, just a bit that can run with a new kind of algorithm that does anomaly detection, that looks for a certain vibration or a certain sense that something is amiss. So there's a lot of room for innovation there.
We have one more question from Lisha Zhang. Could you share the thoughts on storage support in the long run? Supposedly, the amount of sensing data would grow exponentially. Who or how would how the long-term data storage costs covered? What about the longevity of the data?
Yeah, thank you very much. And I appreciate that question because I forgot to mention it in my talk, so I feel really bad now. So one of our partners where we're storing the data, in addition to Northwestern and San Diego, has been OSN, the Open Storage Network, Alex Zelay, these storage pods that provide an object store. And so right now, all of the Sage data is at the object store in San Diego, in this case. And the team there allow us and give us terabytes and terabytes of space. Thankfully, the relationship with them has been very good. We're very thankful to the sponsors of that, which is both NSF and private donors. And so right now we've asked for space there and expanded that space. And the team has said, well, you've asked for a little bit more. You might have eventually have to start to ask for a lot more. That one high-res burn that we did at the prairie generated 250, 300 gigabytes of data, and that was just a couple day burn. So if you really tried to store it all, which you can't, that's why edge computing is necessary. But even so, it's gonna be a lot of data. And so the OSN is a great model. We love that model where they just allow us to make objects and store them in their object store. We also assume that for longevity, we need to store things for 5 and 10 years. And so that's part of NSF's planning always is what's gonna happen with that data. But you're right, it does grow exponentially. It's a time series, right? So it's just gonna keep growing as long as the instrument is there, especially as you add high resolution sensors.
Thank you. We have one final comment from Michael Boucher, and his comment really reflects all our thinking. And it says, a big thank you to you, Pete, for such an incredible talk and for answering the questions. So with that, let me give a, unless there are any other questions.
Well, I'll share a bonus slide. Just for fun, I'll share a slide. Let's see here. After we had several nodes up, we were talking about the tragic eruption of the volcano, the underwater volcano, and our collaborators in Oregon said, "Did you guys detect anything?" And we, you know, we have sensors that are pretty simple sensors. We didn't really think about it much, and we said, "Well, we should go look." So Rajesh went off and looked at some of the sensors. We had one in Oklahoma, Texas, and the one in Utah was not quite up and running yet. We had one in Oregon. And sure enough, even just with a simple $3 air pressure sensor, just a pressure, humidity, temperature kind of sensor, we could see that wave, the pressure wave, as it rotated and bounced around the planet a couple times. And this really goes to the point I mentioned about anomaly detection. After this happened, we realized, crud, we need a set of algorithms that would have seen this discontinuity and running that at the edge 24/7. So when we see a pressure wave, it immediately alerts us, right? This is the kind of multi-messenger science that physicists do, right? Where you notice an anomaly and you can report to other instruments. So we want to add that anomaly detection. That's a new area that we would love to do, but it also shows the power of this kind of gathering and what we could do with processing at the edge. And so with that, I'll wrap up.
Thank you, Pete. Again, this is fascinating. Really, thank you for taking the time. We appreciate your talk, and thanks to everybody for attending. And I just want to remind our NSF colleagues that there is a QA session later in the afternoon with Pete. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Manish. Thank you.